This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams, so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
It's time for the November episode of Radio Astronomy, listeners. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Production editor Neil McKim.
Hello.
And staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Geraint Lewis about the Andromeda Galaxy's cannibalistic ways and telling you our top stargazing tip to see in this month's night sky. But for now, we're going to take a look over what we found out whilst putting together the November issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. Getting started with Apollo 12, which has its 50th anniversary this year. The mission took off from Cape Canaveral on the 14th of November in 1969, heading towards the Ocean of Storms on the moon, which is kind of actually an appropriate place to be heading, seeing as soon as they took off, they got hit by lightning. Not once, but twice.
Yeah, I mean, you can't help but imagine what it would be like to be strapped to a Saturn V and being launched towards the moon, and that would be scary enough as it is. But then to actually then, throughout the journey, be hit by lightning twice?
Twice, not just once, twice. Yeah. And also having all their controls going completely haywire. Mm. Everything was flashing.
Yes.
I didn't know what to do. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you're on top of what is essentially a gigantic 100-meter-high bomb.
Yeah.
And then first everything starts flashing and then goes dead. That was quite scary for them. But Commander Pete Conrad, he held his cool because apparently they were all Navy boys on this flight, all three of them, and they have a mantra in the Navy flight school, which is, if your plane is going in the right direction, don't do anything. It's okay. It's all good. Like, even if everything in the world drops out. So he held his cool and he didn't pull the abort lever. He left it time for ground control to work out what was wrong. And then eventually an engineer who had happened to track down this very specific problem in testing suggested that they have this obscure switch called the SCE and switch it to AUX.
That saved them.
And it also happened to be that Alan Bean, who was the lunar module pilot, knew exactly where the switch was and knew to flick it.
Because I'd read that their kind of hand was like hovering over the abort button.
Yeah.
And you can imagine, like, part of you'd be going, oh my God, we've got to abort. But then part of you'd be going, well, this we've prepared for so long. Let's just leave it another few seconds. you know, until the very last minute, because, you know, you don't want to just have to kind of wait for another month and do this all over again. But I'd also read that the lightning strikes had affected the fuel cells, so the command service module was put on batteries. Is that correct?
They did definitely have a couple of things that they weren't 100% sure what was going on. Things like the issue with the batteries. But also one of the big things is ground control weren't 100% sure that the lightning strike hadn't set the parachute off early. And that was the parachute that they needed to come home.
So they spent the whole mission not knowing whether they'd get back or not.
Yeah.
The crew were fine because they didn't tell the crew.
Oh, yes.
Because you wouldn't, would you?
No. It's apparently that's a thing that is quite often if there's a problem that you can't fix that might result in the death of your crew, they quite often don't get told.
Yeah.
Because you just sit there worrying the entire time. And if there's nothing you can do.
So when they got to the moon, their troubles weren't over, were they?
No, their troubles were rapidly coming to a middle.
not even an end. Yeah.
So, yes,
they wrecked the camera.
They wrecked the camera almost immediately. Yeah. They accidentally pointed it at the sun. For just a couple of seconds by the sounds of it. And it's the sun. There's no atmosphere. There's no protection. The lens didn't have any sort of shielding on it. And it just fried the sensor of the camera, which was unfortunate because it was supposed to broadcast back live television footage.
Yes.
And it was supposed to be the first colour footage from the surface of the moon. Mm. I mean, that's quite that's gold dust, isn't it?
Yeah.
Almost as important as the first step on the moon, from a kind of PR, public-facing point of view.
Definitely, and I'd read also that some of the TV networks had, like, sold advertising around it and everything, and
cleared
all this kind of
schedules,
stuff.
Cleared the schedules, like, made advertising, and then they didn't have anything to show. So, that was...
Yeah.
Was there ever any kind of explanation as to how and why the camera was pointed at the sun? Was it just, like...
It was just one of those things if, you know, they were trying to do half a dozen things at once whilst in these massive bulky spacesuits. And just, I think they basically got the direction of the camera a bit wrong and happened to point it in the wrong direction and it just got into the sunbeam.
And wasn't there also an issue with the camera on one of the film in one of the cameras?
Yeah, they left one, they lost a canister of film. Because basically what happens when one of the Apollo missions, they get to the moon, is they throw out all of their rubbish and leave it around the lander so they don't have to take it back. And whilst they were doing that, they accidentally threw out one of the film canisters.
Oh, no.
And apparently they like had a search for it, but they couldn't find it. So somewhere up there on the moon, amongst all the other rubbish left behind by Apollo 12, is a canister of film.
Wow.
Well, though it's like, probably not any good anymore, having been, you know, 50 years of sun radiation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I was going to say, wouldn't that be really cool if it'd be like a kind of found footage thing? You know, you could watch it back, but no, I guess it's probably completely destroyed.
Yeah.
On the plus side, they did manage to do a precision landing and the first meet up with lander that was already on the surface, didn't they?
Yeah, that was really cool.
Only time we've done that so far, I think, gone back
to
something.
The first and only.
Suvera 3, wasn't it? It was like an unmanned probe that had landed in April 1967, and they managed to land within walking distance of it.
Yeah, it was something like just under 200 metres. It was astonishingly close.
That's so cool,
isn't it?
Considering the problems that, you know, the Apollo 11 crew had, you know, having to kind of land far away from the planned landing site. And,
because they were like miles away. And this one was down to 200 meters. It's astonishing.
Yeah,
And it's interesting to see that while Apollo 11 they only did one EVA, one moonwalk, lasting 3 hours. This did they did two, didn't they? On this,
and four hours each.
Yeah, 4 hours each. So they're kind of, you know, even that one mission, they were improving.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to forget because Apollo 11 is the one that gets all of the publicity. But Apollo 11 was just a kind of, can we do this mission? it was a test. It was seeing, can we get out onto the surface? Can we wander around?
Will we sink on the lunar surface?
It was interesting to read that Commander Conrad was the first person to fall over on the moon.
There's not from Apollo 12, but there's some footage from one of the other Apollo missions of people falling over and trying to struggle to get back up again. Apparently, it's relatively easy to get up again because the moon's gravity is quite light. So even though you're wearing this massive bulky suit, it's quite easy to get back up again.
So could you just do like a really, really hard push-up? And you would just keep on going up.
I think that's essentially how you stand up on the moon.
Or if you fell over, like if you fall over on a trampoline and you can kind of bounce your way up again.
But yeah, apparently it's quite easy to fall over on the moon because the gravity is all wrong. So you lean too far forward and then you go over your center of balance and fall flat on your face.
Wasn't it the case, I mean, like apart from Apollo 13, obviously, wasn't it the case that with each subsequent Apollo mission, the EVAs got longer and more frequent, so they were kind of pushing it more and more each time?
Each one got longer and longer. I think by the end of it, Apollo 17 stayed on the surface for something like 3 days.
Yeah. And they had moon buggies and things.
So that they could go a lot further. That's how you do all kind of exploration, is you take one step and then you take a little walk, and then you go for a run, and then you get a car. that's what happened, right?
There was a really interesting thing I found online when I was kind of I've been reading about this over the past week. You can still find the Apollo 12 press kit, like the original press kit that was given to journalists. I'm assuming that's probably the case for all the Apollo missions. You can probably find the press kits, but it's really cool if you just type Apollo 12 press kit into your search engine, and NASA have provided this PDF, and you can get info on their diet and what they ate and like how they brushed their teeth and all this kind of stuff. It's really, really cool.
You can also find all of the transcripts from all of the missions.
Mm.
Admittedly, most of it is lots of numbers and letters, which make no sense to anybody who isn't a flight engineer.
Okay.
But it's quite interesting sort of tracking down, you know, the actual moment where, you know, Neil Armstrong first stepped onto the moon or stuff like that. But now from one moon in our solar system to another. Neil, what have you been looking at this month?
Well, I've been interested to read about some recent news concerning volcanic activity, or lack of, on a couple of moons in the solar system. The first, which we covered in the mag, was news about Loki, which is the largest and most powerful volcano on Jupiter's moon Io. And this was due to erupt in September, but basically could blow any day now. And researchers anticipate that the volcano should erupt every 475 days, but it's definitely been keeping everyone waiting. And maybe it's living up to its name, as Marvel fans may well know already. It's the Norse god of mischief. Io is apparently the most volcanically active body in our solar system, I was reading, with hundreds of visible volcanic events, and the matter is blasted hundreds of kilometres from the moon's surface.
I always think that's weird, because when you, like, if you look at all of the other moons around the outer gas giants, they're all like massive balls of ice, occasionally like some rocky ones as well, but the big ones are all ice. And then you've got this massive volcanic world, and apparently that's due because it's so close to Jupiter. I think Io is actually the closest moon to Jupiter, that the gravitational pull, the tidal forces, just liquefy the center, basically. It makes it so hot that it has these enormous volcanoes and huge amounts of volcanic activity.
I read somewhere a while ago that it was the same with Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, because it's like Enceladus around Saturn. It has an icy crust, but then they think liquid water underneath, and you kind of think, well, how's that possible? But yeah, it's to do with the kind of internal heating as a result of its kind of pulling to and fro by Jupiter.
It would be amazing when it erupts, isn't it? I mean, we're going to, you know, be able to see evidence of the plume and some of the kind of matter flying up into tenuous atmosphere.
It astounds me that we can see that from Earth. I think they have to use like infrared cameras and stuff to do it, but it's just, you know, thinking back to where we were 60, 50 years ago when Apollo was happening, and now we can see these amazing things happening all the way across the solar system.
Yeah.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
But apparently, so in the 1990s, Io was, they thought, was erupting roughly once every 540 days, and now it's once every 475 days, so it's becoming more frequent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I guess you might have thought that it would become less frequent over time. I'm not sure why, but...
Well, it's a trickster moon. What do you expect?
But it reminds me of the story of Linda Morabito, one of the Voyager scientists who discovered the volcanoes on Io. And it was the story of her kind of... I think she was like... alone in the room looking at the images, and she was just using them to calculate the centers of the bodies. That was something they had to do with the Voyager mission. When she looked at the crescent of the moon, it basically jumped out at her. There was just this object and she didn't know what it was. And she was the only person, I think it was like 3 a.m. or something, everyone else had gone home. But because she was kind of like a young, newly graduated planetary scientist, she was like really interested and she kind of sat there. And once she worked out what it was, she said that she was sitting thinking, I'm the only person in the world who knows this.
Mm. Yeah.
Amazing. Galileo moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's quite often you hear these stories of the people who, from various space missions, especially in the past when it was, you know, coming in on like sort of strips of tape and they were putting together, like literally gluing together the pictures from like Viking or Voyager or something. And it's like, I am the first person to be seeing this picture from another world. And that must be an incredible feeling.
Yeah.
There's also some news in about Enceladus, which is Saturn's moon. And by looking through data collected by the Cassini mission, scientists from Berlin's Free University have basically been looking at the ice grains, which were analysed by Cassini's cosmic dust analyzer, and detected in Saturn's outermost E-ring. And these grains have been produced after the volcanic material from the moon's core was ejected through the hydrothermal vents and mixed with water in the subsurface ocean. And by analysing this matter, researchers detected traces of organic compounds that are nitrogen and oxygen bearing. Mm-hmm. And the exciting thing is that on Earth, similar compounds are part of chemical reactions which produce amino acids.
Mm. Yeah, so organic doesn't always mean biological.
It's just carbon-based.
Yeah, it's just carbon-based. But they are the kind of like the building blocks of life. And even if there's no life on Enceladus or any of these other icy moons, it's really interesting to find out where these things come from to sort of understand how our own planet's life evolved.
Mm. Definitely. I mean, it was one of the highlights of the Cassini mission, really. It was towards the end of the mission. The Cassini spacecraft was just doing these cool plume dives because these plumes erupt regularly on Enceladus, and the spacecraft was actually flying through these plumes erupting from the subsurface ocean just below Enceladus' icy crust and collecting all the data. And then, but obviously, I think when did the Cassini mission end? 2017, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the actual spacecraft's mission, and then is over. But then the data will be kind of analysed and studied for decades to come.
Mm.
And this is just kind of one of the most recent discoveries that has come out of that. And we were talking about Europa there, and that's going to be kind of one of the next big missions is the Europa Clipper mission to kind of do a similar kind of study of Jupiter's moon.
It's interesting. We're talking about Io and the kind of tidal forces acting on the moon to create that huge volcanism there. You know, Saturn's a similarly sized moon, and there is that kind of the similar. You know, there is a tidal force acting on Enceladus. So they think that kind of the source of energy to create those amino acids could be there in Enceladus. Similarly to, you know, it's the kind of thing that, like on Earth, there are hydrothermal vents which produce these amino acids. So a similar kind of process could be happening, you know, in this kind of sealed off world that's been developing on its own for since the birth of the solar system.
Mind blowing.
Especially as they think hydrothermal vents is where life possibly started on Earth in the first place. So it might not be in our lifetime we'll ever find out, but maybe somebody will go and have a look one day.
I guess it comes back to that thing where if you're looking for life elsewhere in the solar system, or at least conditions suitable for supporting life as we know it, you kind of look for liquid, don't you? Like you look for water and
follow the water.
Follow the water and follow the, you know, the building blocks of life as we know it so far. Tick all the easy boxes off, get the easy wins in first, and then start looking for crazy life, you know, other silica-based life forms or whatever there is. That's the strategy, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
For the search for life.
But from our neighbour planet, our neighbour moons, to our neighbour galaxy. So, Ian, what's been going on in Andromeda this month?
Yes, that's right. I've been kind of concentrating on this story that came out a few days ago as we're recording. Astronomers in Australia have been studying the Andromeda galaxy's feeding habits. Andromeda, as you said, is a neighbouring galaxy of our own galaxy, the Milky Way, and it's grown throughout its life by enveloping smaller galaxies along the way. And the team behind this new study have been able to see the remains of smaller galaxies that have been consumed by Andromeda, and they're using this information to learn more about the galaxy's history. And this week, we were paid a visit by Geraint Lewis from the University of Sydney, who's one of the co-authors of this study, and he happened to be in the UK, so he dropped by our Bristol studio. And I began by asking Geraint how the discovery came about.
So this is something we had published in Nature last week. And actually, this is something that we've been working on for roughly 20 years now, is to try and understand the feeding habits of large galaxies. Because what we understand is that even galaxies like our own Milky Way, which are currently, you know, a few hundred billion stars, have grown over time. And they grow by basically this process of galactic cannibalism. Small galaxies get a little bit too close, and then the gravity of the big galaxy tears the small galaxies apart, and their stars are added to the big galaxy. So what we want to know is just what kind of feeding have these big galaxies been doing? Are they like little snack feeders, a little bit, and very often, or are they binge eaters? And what we saw with our results last week, it looks like Andromeda went through two big stages of binge eating, one relatively recent in the last 3 billion years or so, and one much older, probably 7 to 10 billion years.
I think, like, as interesting as all this is, I think most people would kind of say, but how could you possibly know? What sort of observations were you guys carrying out in order to discover this?
So as I said, this is a long-term program. So we have two sort of attacks to solve the problem. Firstly, we wanted to image the outer regions of Andromeda. So anyone who has observed Andromeda, you know, you can see Andromeda with your naked eye if you know where you're looking. And we know that the actual optical disk of Andromeda is several times bigger than the full moon. But we wanted to sort of image the halo of Andromeda. So this is this large, tenuous sort of region beyond the stellar disk. So it covers a huge swathe of sky, and we wanted to observe it very deeply because we wanted to find individual stars. So we had a very large mapping program with the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope that allowed us to capture large bits of sky in very fine detail. So we could pick out individual stars in the halo of Andromeda. They're giant stars, so they're very bright, but you know, they're very faint in terms of the observations. And so the first thing that revealed is essentially all this substructure, all these sort of chunks and streams of stars surrounding Andromeda. And these are sort of the ongoing accretion events. These are things being ripped apart right now, and their stars are being added to Andromeda. The other thing we want to do is measure the speeds of those stars. So we needed to do spectroscopy. So we had to, you know, analyze the light. And to do that, we had to go to bigger telescopes. And there we used the 10-meter Keck telescope and the 8-meter Gemini telescope to get the spectra of individual stars and measure their speeds from the Doppler shift. So we then can build up this picture of where these stars are and how fast they are moving. And from that, we could start to piece together what kind of feeding habits Andromeda's had.
So is a lot of this kind of using computers to almost rewind, kind of take the current situation and rewind and work out what's happened?
That's what we're trying to do. The problem is that we don't have all the information, right? So we have the velocity along the line of sight towards Andromeda, but not in the plane of the sky. So Andromeda's too far away to get proper motions. So we only have a limited amount of velocity information, and it's very hard to actually get the full three-dimensional spatial structure of the stars. So we're working from a sort of limited data sense, but this is what we now want to do, is trying to piece together the overall dynamical history of that stuff. And we do that, as you said, we do computer simulations. We can put in the effects of gravity and try and rebuild up the accretion to understand, you know, what has Andromeda been doing for 10 billion years?
Yeah, because if you have these kind of remnants of galaxies that have been eaten by the Andromeda galaxy, how do you know that they are remnants of galaxies? Couldn't they just be kind of star clusters that have wandered close?
So I said we can count the individual stars. So we know when we see a stream or a chunk of stars, we can count up the number of giant stars, and that tells us essentially how many stars there are in total. And so the masses of these things are much bigger than just typical star clusters. So for a dwarf galaxy, this is what we think fell in to be accreted, or you know, many of these things. We are now getting into the, you know, very low numbers of billions of stars. So they're bigger than star clusters. They're definitely dwarf galaxies. And we can also tell from the chemistry of these objects. The chemistry tells you something about the size of the gravitational potential in which these things exist. And so, yeah, again, this points to the fact that these are dwarf galaxies that fell in and brought in billions of stars at a time.
Do you think that there might then be other galaxies that have been eaten that you haven't yet discovered yet?
So we know that there probably are more ancient accretions. This is how we are able to date some of this stuff. The ancient ones that fell in, they've been orbiting so many times, they've been completely disrupted and their stars are very smoothly spread out. And what we're seeing now are only the more recent ones. But also around Andromeda, we see there are roughly 30 other intact dwarf galaxies, and they're potentially food for the future. So, you know, this notion of galaxy evolution, it hasn't ended. It's an ongoing thing. So I said we want to chart out what has happened to now and also what's going to happen into the future.
When I was reading about this study, there was a really interesting aspect of it that I couldn't quite wrap my head around. And it was this notion of the plane of satellites. And it was the fact that the direction or the orientation of those smaller galaxies could tell you something a bit strange about the cosmic web.
Yeah, so as with all research, right, you do all this research to answer questions and you end up with more questions than you get answers in the end. So back in 2014, this was part of our study as well. We'd discovered these 30-odd dwarf galaxies orbiting Andromeda. We measured their positions, their distances and their speeds. And what we found is roughly half of them are orbiting in a very coherent sense. They're in a very flat plane, all orbiting around Andromeda in the same way. And this is somewhat mysterious because you might expect that dwarf galaxies could rain in from any direction. So they should be sort of buzzing around like a swarm of bees. But what we're seeing is there's this ordered motion as these things move around. And so the question is where did this ordered motion come from? And what we sort of, some ideas that we have is that we know that material is fed into large galaxies from this thing called the cosmic web, where we have these dense knots of galaxies and clusters separated by voids and sheets and filaments. And so maybe it comes from the fact that material has been fed down the cosmic web and into the Andromeda, and also the Milky Way has a similar structure in a very precise way to give you this very planar structure of dwarf galaxies. But not everybody's convinced that that's the answer. Some people think that this is a sign that we've got something else radically wrong. And there's a small but vocal group that thinks that this is a sign that we actually have our notions of gravity wrong, that something like this plane of satellites forms when you have a collision between two big galaxies. And the only way you can make it work is by not having standard gravity as we understand it. So this is this notion of modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND as it's called. So some people say that this small scale weirdness in the universe is telling us something more fundamental about the universe. We don't really know if that's the case yet.
I think most people kind of, well, a lot of people anyway would kind of jump to this conclusion whenever there's something a bit odd going on. But could it in any way be related to, dark matter or dark energy or anything like that?
The answer is yes, of course. I mean, dark matter and dark energy are both somewhat slippery topics in that we have observational evidence that those things are there, but we have very little evidence of what they are. And so, dark matter, while we know it has mass, we don't really know how it's distributed. We don't really know how it interacts. And again, it might be that it has been claims that a particular kind of dark matter can form these planes and possibly have dwarf galaxies in these planes as well. But again, anything goes at the moment because we don't have the observational evidence to say that it's this or that. So open question.
I think it's really interesting you were talking about the cosmic web, because I've seen like an artist's illustration of the cosmic web, and to me it looks like a fishing net or something, just kind of like visible matter and then just these massive patches of blackness. Is that actually the way people think the universe is constructed?
Yes. And so I think of it more like a sponge than a web. I mean, cosmic web is the name. But one of the beautiful things is that one area of research I'm involved in is generating synthetic universes. We build universes on computers. So we look at the evolution of matter in the universe over, you know, the 14 billion years since the Big Bang. And you start off with the matter being effectively smooth, and you just let gravity do its thing. And what you get is that regions of the universe which are slightly overdense, they start attracting matter from the regions of the universe which are slightly underdense. And this sort of cosmic web naturally forms out of this structure. And in fact, it's somewhat terrifying how well it actually matches, right? And the ingredients are only matter, gravity, and cosmic expansion.
Would such a program like that be able to tell you whether or not there had been habitable planets forming, and then extend that to say there may have been extraterrestrial life on this kind of planet, and you could then kind of infer from that whether or not we are alone in the universe or anything like that? Is that the kind of thing that you could discover?
I'm actually writing a grant on this very topic at the moment. It's a difficult question because of resolution. Our computer simulations, where we simulate the universe, has a finite size down to which we sort of think we're getting the calculations right. And that question of planets, et cetera, and even stars occurs on a much smaller scale than our simulations. But to study that, you need to put all of those ingredients in. If you want to understand how a planet forms around a star, you've got to know how that star's formed from the gas and how that gas got there. And that gas got there because of the dark matter. So it's all intertwined from the scale of an individual planet up to the cosmic scale. And so this, we spend a lot of time trying to pin the results between these scales to try and make sure we understand how this on the big scale affects this on the small scale. It's not completely answered yet. And from my research, what I would like to do is try and redo this kind of experiment in other universes where we mess around and change the laws of physics to see if habitable planets are common or rarer in different kinds of universe. So it's still open question, but I think it's a really interesting one.
But if you were to change the laws of physics, would that not create an unrealistic scenario?
Well, it creates an unrealistic scenario for our universe, right? There is this notion of the multiverse, okay? So it leads to pub fights, does the multiverse. It's this notion that our universe could be just one of an almost infinite number of other universes out there somewhere, and that each of these other universes has been essentially imprinted with its own laws of physics. So the laws of physics in some other universe is different to the laws of physics that we have in our universe. And one of the questions that I'm very keen to answer is what's the impact of changing that those laws of physics? I mean, is the formation of stars and planets just a generic thing that happens in any old universe with any old physics? And what we already know is that doesn't seem to be the case. If you stray a little bit away from the laws of physics that we have, i.e. you make gravity a bit stronger, you change the strength of the electromagnetic force, you rapidly end up killing the potential for life in the universe. So this is this thing called cosmological fine-tuning. Why do the laws of physics in the universe that we have seem to be just right for us to be here? And as I said, it leads to pub fights a lot of the time when people get to discuss this.
Does the view of the multiverse come from the notion of an infinite universe? In other words, if the universe is infinite, anything's possible?
That's one version of the multiverse. I should, you know, lay the cards on the table. The multiverse is not a single idea. It's a group of ideas, and nobody's quite sure if all the pieces are part of the final answer. There is one version of the multiverse, which is that there's just our universe, but physics is different over there to compared to here, but over there is so far away that we would never have contact with it. And so if you've got an infinite universe, you can fill it full of infinite patches of over theres with different kinds of physics. There's another notion of the multiverse where universes are actually individual universes in a higher dimensional multiverse. Again, we don't know which is the right kind of picture, and we don't even really know how to test those pictures, but I think it's pretty cool to think about them.
Definitely. There was actually one aspect of your Andromeda paper that I wanted to just come back to, because I really wanted to kind of talk to you about it, and it was basically this idea that the Andromeda galaxy is eventually going to consume our own galaxy, the Milky Way, isn't it?
Consume is possibly not the right word, okay. but so what's happening is that Andromeda and the Milky Way are hurtling towards each other. And then in roughly about 3.5 to 4 billion years, they're going to collide. So over most of their history, right, the Milky Way and Andromeda are very similar sized galaxies, and they've been consuming smaller galaxies. And because it's not a Hollywood script, right, in galaxies, the big guy always wins, right? The little galaxies get torn apart. When Andromeda and the Milky Way meet, because they're roughly equal size, they're going to end up totally disrupting each other. So they're going to approach each other. The gravitational attraction is going to rip apart the beautiful spiral disks that define these galaxies. And eventually, all the stars will be either thrown out into intergalactic space or merged back together into a really sort of boring-looking elliptical galaxy. I mean, it would be great to be around to see that collision because, you know, you would see Andromeda getting larger on the sky. It would become very, very visible. Then you would see the spiral arms sort of warp and distort. Then gas clouds in the galaxies would collide and you'd get this new burst of star formation. So the sky would light up like a Christmas tree. Gas would get funneled down into the black holes at the centers of the galaxies due to the disruption. So the centers of the galaxies would light up as well. So this would go on for a few billion years. But after that, then everything would settle down and we'd be left over with this rather amorphous blob, which is, it's called Milkometer. I really hate that name. But it's the leftover remnants of the collision between the two big galaxies.
Oh, I just got it because it's a merging of the two names. Yeah, I just got that. But like, would Earth survive? Like, if we were still alive, what would actually happen to us?
So there's a couple of things you have to think about. So firstly, when you have two big galaxies or galaxies of any size colliding, it's an amazing fact that stars themselves are actually tiny compared to the distances between stars. So in a collision between galaxies, the chances of one star hitting another star are almost zero. So the stars will just sail past each other and they will probably hold on to most of their planets, right? Other than the stuff in the outermost regions of like the solar system. So yes, the Earth could survive that kind of collision. But the big problem we have is that we're now talking of timescales 4, 5, 6 billion years. And we know that the sun is roughly, you know, already 5 billion years old and is halfway through its lifespan. And over the next 3, 4, 5 billion years, the sun is going to stop in a nice sort of G-type dwarf that it is today and start expanding into its red giant phase. And on these long timescales, the sun will have expanded so much that it will have swallowed Mercury, Venus, Earth, and then possibly Mars as well before the sun enters it, you know, it, the late stages of its evolution. So if we want to see it, we should move over to a younger star. And I think the view would be rather spectacular. But on that timescale, it's the end of the solar system and the sun.
Right.
Sorry, there's no happy endings in astronomy. You know this, right?
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we'll leave it there, Geraint. Thanks very much for coming into the studio today and speaking to us.
Thank you very much. It was great.
That was an excerpt of our interview with Geraint Lewis from the University of Sydney, and you can watch the entire interview on the BBC Sky Night Magazine YouTube channel, during which we discuss the search for extraterrestrial life and the prospect of multi-universes. And you can also find out more about this story in the November issue of BBC Sky Night Magazine.
There's lots to see in November's night sky as the days begin to get really short. But if there's one thing you really should see, it's the transit of Mercury on the 11th of November. This is a line of sight effect where, from our view on planet Earth, we can watch as the closest planet to the Sun moves slowly across the Sun's face. Mercury will look small against the Sun, so you'll need a telescope to see it. And as with any time you're observing the Sun, you must protect your eyesight. So use a proper solar filter, like a white light filter, which screens out 99.9% of the energy in sunlight, or a hydrogen alpha filter, which lets only one particular wavelength of sunlight through to your eyes. Mercury takes about 4.5 hours to cross the sun's disk. In the UK, the transit starts at 12:35 p.m, and it's still going when the sun sets at 22 minutes past four, so we'll miss the last phases of the event. The entire transit is visible from the eastern seaboard of North America, from Newfoundland in Canada to Louisiana on the Gulf Coast, and Central and South America. So, while you won't see this transit with eclipse glasses, it's well worth trying to get a view of it, not least because a Mercury transit won't happen again until 2032.
So that's it from us this month. Good luck in your transit viewing, particularly if you're in the northern US, central or southern America, where you hopefully should be able to see the whole thing. If any of you happen to be lucky enough to get to see the whole thing, do let us know by emailing us at contactus@skyatnightmagazine.com, getting in touch on Twitter at skyatnightmag, or on Facebook. We always love to hear from you guys. You can find out more about the transit of Mercury in the November issue of BBC Sky and Our magazine, where we also take a tour of supernova remnants to celebrate a cosmic fireworks night, look at how astronomy has changed the way we look at our own planet, and show you how to get crafty and make your own lunar crater. That's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast or Spotify.